It's on. Fuck, its battery seems to be still good, so we're probably all right with recording. All right, so as usual, first step is, do you have questions from stuff we did last class? And then the next will be, do you have questions from stuff we're doing for this class? And that's the thing that we're going to be discussing once we finish that stage. Any questions from last class? You understand the basic discussion of contracting from the standpoint of the book and of my arguments. Yes. I guess for this class, we really might as well go to there. So that's the electronic equipment service contract. And I don't know if there is some way with this device I can make the print bigger. I'd like it. Actually, what is it? It's HTML. So, for each contract, can we in some sense summarize the questions we're going to be asking? What would you like to know if you're deciding on a contract? What do you want to know about the effect of the different rules? Most general level, whose behavior do you care about? By the producer, do you mean GCI or RRR?
The maintenance company.
What?
The maintenance company.
So you'd like to think about incentives for RRR of the two forms of contracts. All right? What sort of decisions is RRR making that you care about? What do you want to give them an incentive to do or not to do by your contract?
They have an incentive to spend the least amount of time just to fix the problem so that they get the job done versus spending the service time to repair something so that it has a long term.
So one question is, you might think of that as repair versus maintenance, if that maintenance isn't quite right, but one way of doing their job is do the least possible so it'll be running 15 minutes from now. And another way is to say do that which will best keep it running for a long time. That's one decision. What else do you care about? If you imagine they're doing their bad job badly, what are the ways in which they can do the job badly?
Long time to do the same amount of work or the same quality or whatever work.
Time spent?
Yeah, work very slow.
Okay. And what other issues might arise?
If it were a cost plus contract, you'd be worried about them.
There are only two alternative contracts being discussed in this particular problem. One of them is a fixed payment and one of them is an hourly.
You just said what they'd be thinking about. So.
Yeah, you could already think of other contracts as well. For a moment, at least, let's limit it to the two that are here. And what else might they do badly? Yep.
Well, it's along the maintenance issue, I guess parts they use might be.
Quality of parts? Although I think both of the contracts, as I recall, I don't remember charging for parts on the first one. The first one they're not charging for parts, you're right. So the first one, they have an incentive to use cheap parts.
Right.
What limits their incentive to use cheap parts? Or putting it differently, just how bad parts do they want to use?
Well, if they use bad parts, then we get it from the back more often.
And in the first contract, that's a cost to them.
Right.
So on the first contract, they ideally want to use parts which will break down after the term of their agreement with you. And they'd like to save money by using parts that last for 2 years instead of 10 years, but not to save money by using parts that last for a month instead of a year, because then they will be paying the cost of it. Right? So, any other kinds of issues? There's one which isn't really mainly about these two alternatives, but it's going to be a very real issue, and that is their promise. That is, they're supposed to be agreeing to repair promptly. That's very well defined. So what are they agreeing to do, and what's in their interest to do? So you could, maybe you'd need some additional contractual terms to specify whether they, you know, suppose the machine breaks down at 1 in the morning, you've got somebody doing late night work, do they have to send the technician out at 2 in the morning, or are they entitled to wait till 9 the next day? Things like that could be real issues. So suppose we have a fixed price deal. What is their incentive with regard to time spent? Do they want to do the job?
The least amount.
Right. So fixed price looks like an asset for that particular issue. How about the being paid by the time?
Do you have an incentive to be less efficient?
Well, it's a little tricky. What is that going to depend on?
They get more money if they spend more time.
Yeah, but they also have to pay more for their employees if they're using more time, right? Yep.
What does it say cost to them for their hours?
The real question is $75 high or low relative to the real cost of them for sending people out? And if $75 is high, then you have a real problem, because then they've got an incentive to be slow within the limits of what they can do without your refusing to do business with them or something. Whereas if 75 is actually a little less than it costs them, then again, they have not as strong an incentive here. But so let's call that $75 per hour plus and minus, and we'll remember that that depends on how that compares with their real cost. How about quality of parts? Let's just take the quality of parts one. Under the fixed price deal, we've just said they have an incentive to use parts that won't break down fast, but no incentive to use parts that will last really long, as it were. How about under the basically cost based system? Yep.
It seems like they have no incentive to go out and get prices for parts because the cost is to be passed on.
Right. So therefore, in this one, fixed price is sort of ambiguous, but at least best price they can get for a given quality, but then there are going to be quality issues. Quality, question mark. And on this one, they're going to be on the 75, what's going to happen? No incentive, not best price. Very legible, but you remember what we're saying. And they might as well get, it's not clear whether that's a little tricky, whether they want to get good parts, again, depends on whether they're being overpaid or underpaid for their time. If they're being overpaid for their time, then, well, it breaks down again. Yeah, it makes more money. Where it's being underpaid, then not. All of which suggests that what you might want to do if you were thinking about this contract is to try to deliberately set it slightly underpay them for their time on the grounds that'll give you some small incentive problems, but eliminate some big incentive problems. And that makes sense. Let's see. Other
areas? I just want to look at my notes and see what I thought we ought to do, because I'm pretty sure I had some more things we had to worry about with regard to RRR.
How about risk? Who is bearing the risk in each of these contracts?
Yep. Well, you asked about any other thoughts or considerations.
Yes.
I would want to know how often I expect these machines to break down, and how often I can expect them to get repaired, even if they are worked on very slowly or very quickly. If they break down only once every 4 to 5 years, and a repair takes only 15 minutes, then even if they're working at half pace, it's still much more economic to go with the cost per hour. On the other hand, if they break down all the time, and it always takes a really long time to repair them, no matter what.
I don't see why one of them is more economic than the other, because, of course, if they break down a whole lot, then for the fixed price contract, they'll charge you a very high price. Right? But it seems to me, obviously, you would always rather pay them, $100 than $200. But in terms of choosing the form of the contract, whether you want a fixed price contract or some sort of a cost or cost plus contract, the fact that a cost-plus contract can be very expensive because they're going to spend a lot of time there isn't an argument against it, because if they're going to spend a lot of time there and they know they're going to, then a fixed-price contract would be expensive too, right? They're not going to be working at a loss. Is that right? Am I missing something?
I understand what you mean. Unless they have the same rate, regardless of whether they spend a lot of time there or a little time there.
But they surely, when they're negotiating the rate to start with, unless they're stupid, they're not going to offer a low rate for a job where they expect it cost them a whole lot to do. Right? They don't want to work at a loss.
Unless they have multiple contracts and they offer the same rate to every customer.
Maybe, I suppose, yeah. No, I agree. It's logically possible that they do a poor job. Maybe it's an asymmetric information case. They can't easily tell which ones are expensive, but the customer can, and then the customer is going to want fixed price if he thinks he's unusually expensive. But of course, on that assumption, the service agency is going to have a higher than average, as it were, fixed price, because it knows the people who choose the fixed price are going to be the bad risk. Which we're back with adverse selection there. Let's go back to it. Yep.
So I think on the fixed rate, the risk is on RRR, that it will exceed $200 their cost to do repairs.
Right. So on the fixed rate, so the fixed price RRR takes the risk. If it turns out that they misestimated, if it turns out that the machines break down much more often than they expect, then they're going to be the ones who take the loss. And of course, if it break down less often, they expect to get a gain. That's the risk goes both directions. Whereas with the $75 an hour, whether they're going to call cost plus or something, now it's, what's the name of the other company? CGI, I think.
That's I at the end.
Yes. CGI is
GCI
is taking the risk, because if it turns out to break down a lot, they have to pay a lot for repairs. So one relevant question would be, if RRR is a big company with lots and lots of customers, they may be happy to bear the risk because they can, in effect, risk pool across their customers. Whereas if they're the small company and GCI is doing a whole lot of different things, then maybe they can help.
Could there also be a holdout problem, like the book mentioned? At $75 per hour, you can get as many machines as you want serviced, but at a cost per machine basis, they can hold out for more with additional machines.
Now, you mean if machines are added during the period of contract?
Renegotiation.
Yes, you're right. One of the things you might want to think about is renegotiation issues. If it turns out that GCI is having a really good year and they decide to buy some more machines, does the contract specify that RRR agrees to cover them at the same rate? So this contract is done as a per machine, not a fixed rate, so that it looks as though that's designed in a sense to cover that problem. Or in the form of existing machines, and here's the total rate, then you'd have a real problem with negotiating when you decide to get more or fewer machines, right? Because you might say we want to pay you less because we've decided we don't need as many machines because it's we're having a recession and we're not as much business as usual. And so those are all legitimate issues. issues. Let me see what else I had on my notes. There's in general the question of the incentive, not exactly repair versus maintenance, but how good a job you fix. Do you, you know, after all, RRR can probably get not very good technicians cheaper than they can get good technicians. And so you might argue that on the $75 an hour thing, instead of getting really good technicians, they get technicians who take 10% longer and things often break down again a week later, whereas with the fixed price one, they're absorbing the cost of low quality work, right? So there's a quality issue there, their own technicians as well. And going back to the question of promptness, you might want to add to either contract some sort of a penalty clause saying if a machine is down for more than 4 hours, then we reduce the amount we pay you or something of that sort. Or a bonus, you could say that if the total length of time machines are out for this month comes to less than 2 hours per machine, we'll give you an extra payment. We think of a variety of ways in which you can make sure that their reward depended on. Now, all of those obviously are also going to have to have further issue of can you tell them? You know, you have to, you're going to have a little bit of extra trouble in filling out a form which says, you know, we reported it at 3 p.m., he arrived at 3:30, it was fixed by 5. So that should be some close. Is RRR the only people whose incentives you have to worry about setting up the contract? How might the
Yup? The sense of RRR has the knowledge of how old machines are and how many repairs have been done. Some machines they may know break down every week. Some machines may only break down once a year. So unless RRR has the information and they use their contract, then CGI has a benefit in that.
That was the problem we were discussing before in a way of asymmetric information. But I was thinking of the incentives of the different contract forms for GCI. That what might GCI have an incentive to do if the contract is written the wrong way? What might you worry about?
They're just going to be super hard on the machines if they don't have to absorb the cost.
Right. So one problem is how they treat the machines. That, you know, this machine says it's got a duty cycle of, you know, 2,000 pages an hour. After that, it might heat up. Well, do you follow that rule or not? The machine, think about a inkjet printer. They probably are using inkjet printers. As fancy as those they are, you can buy the ink from the manufacturer, but you can also buy refilled ink containers from third parties at a lower cost, and you might even be able to buy kits for refilling them yourself. And my guess, without much experience of it, is that the lower cost ones also have higher risk of jamming, of, you know, in various ways causing problems.
So could it be like maybe they know like a little repairman that charges a lot less, but they only have small problems versus if they have a $75 hour contract, that they might go with something like maybe they didn't need just like jam them. They know it's not going to be a big deal, but they know that from experience, every time they call people, they take 2 hours.
So one question you might want to think about is GCI free to hire other people as well? And they're not going to want to on the fixed price contract, but they might very well want to on the other, and that would, you know, in a certain way, be a way of disciplining RRR against some of the things it might do. But I was actually thinking about whether GCI would cut corners by using the cheapest ink, by using lower quality paper and things of that sort, which on the fixed price contract, well, if it does break down, RRR is paying the cost, whereas on the $75 an hour one, they've got an incentive not to do it. So you do want to think about GCI incentives as well. And this is a general point that in almost any contract situation, the form of the contract affects incentives of both parties. And you imagine yourself as one party and say, well, I don't have to worry about that. I can just, you know, not do bad things. But, of course, if you set up a contract where it's in your interest to do bad things, then you will. And if the other party knows that the contract is set up so it's in your interest to do bad things, they're going to price accordingly. All right, so if GCI said, well, it's true that under this fixed price contract, we have no incentive to use good quality materials, good quality inputs to our machines, but that's all right, that'll save us money. That would be a mistake, given that they ought to realize that RRR knows that too, and therefore we'll price accordingly. So that is the general point. That you really, in designing everything except the price, you want to look at it from above, as it were, thinking of each party as potentially opportunistic, trying to minimize it with only costs. It's only in arguing over the price if you're on one side. Sort of part of the logic. How about the machines themselves? If GCI has a fixed price contract, and they decide to replace one of their machines, and one of their machines is hopelessly bad, and they need a new machine, what is their incentive with regard to the quality of that machine, according to whether it's whether they have a fixed price or a cost-based contract? Yeah?
Are you asking whether they would demand for a newer machine if they have to keep...
No, I'm saying when they buy a new machine, they can buy the cheapest machine or the cheapest copier out there, or they can buy an expensive high-quality copier. One of the virtues of high-quality copiers, one hopes, is they never break down, or at least they break down much more rarely. If GCI is paying the cost of breakdowns, which they are under the $75 an hour, then that gives them an incentive in deciding on the quality of machine to get to include in their calculation the benefit of it's not breaking down. If they've got a fixed price contract, on the other hand, they may reasonably enough say, if breaking down isn't a big problem, they've already agreed to pay a fixed amount for taking care of that, and therefore, let's get the cheapest machine we can. Yeah?
I mean, they probably wouldn't get the cheapest machines available, right? Because there's still time to have to call somebody to come out and perform maintenance.
There are some costs, that's right. All I'm saying is not that there are... I'm saying that a large part of the cost, you've got a cost-benefit trade-off in deciding how high-end the machine to get. And that with one of the contracts, a large part of that cost is going to somebody else. And they, therefore, will make the wrong decision in terms of total costs and benefits. Whereas with the other contract, most of it's going to them. I'm reminded, with regard to the general issue of high-quality things not breaking down, about a Rolls-Royce story, probably not true. But the story is that a bunch of English students, college students or graduate students or something, decide to go vacationing in the Middle East. This would be quite a long time ago. And they buy a secondhand old Rolls Royce to do it in. And somewhere in the middle of hell and gone, the rear axle breaks. And they get it towed to a local service station and call up Rolls Royce. And Rolls Royce says, just stay there, we'll take care of it. And 24 hours later, a Rolls-Royce engineer flies into the nearest airport with a replacement rear axle, comes to the service station in Hellangone, puts in the rear axle, flies off again. And the students are a little bit worried because are they going to bill us for this very expensive service? It wasn't under warranty or anything. It's an old secondhand thing. And they get back to England, and the guy who organized the trip is sort of worried that he'll be stuck with the cost. And so he calls up Rolls-Royce and describes what happened. And there's a brief pause on the other end of the line, and the voice comes back, sir, a Rolls-Royce rear axle never breaks. All right. So in that case, at least, they wanted to maintain a reputation, even when it wasn't true. Anyway, I like the story, but I have common tastes in stories, perhaps. I also had some more. Pages. Are those my pages or your pages?
Those are your pages. All right. I'll probably put it down over here.
Yeah. I'll grab my notes on this.
So if you're thinking about CGI's incentives, under the cost plus,
cost plus in this column and fixed price in this column, and buying good machines, cost plus they've got the right incentive, fixed price they've got the quality incentive. Ditto to taking good care of the machines, right? There's a lot of the maintenance being done by them, not by RRR, just in terms of, you know, letting it cool down and clearing paper jams, and hopefully you don't wait for somebody to come out to do that, do it yourself, and so forth. And a related one is, let's suppose that, take the case of a paper jam, something that my printer does occasionally for one reason or another, and you really have a choice. You can either say, well, I bet one of us can fix it, and usually you're right, or you can say, call in RRR. And if you're paying RRR by the hour, you've got the incentive to try the less expensive solution first, as it were. If you're not paying by the hour, still might be quicker, but you've got less incentive to do that. So that would be, think of that as use of RRR. And all of these, what plus means is you have the right incentive. What's the right incentive? The incentive that minimizes total net costs for two by small. Does that make sense? So for the use of RRR, with a fixed price, you've got the wrong incentive. With this one, you've got about the right incentive, depending on what the actual cost is. Similarly, GCI is training its employees, is deciding what employees to get, and whether you know, are willing to hire a farm boy fresh from you know, some rural area who doesn't know nothing about any machine smaller than a tractor. It's all right if he manages, you know, so he shoved that and it broke it. That's all right, call up RRR to take care of it. Or whether you use the more expensive people who are experienced. You can think of a lot of choices of that. So the real point I want to make is that these incentives matter on both sides, not just on, just on one side. And one possibility, which I was suggesting before, which really fits one of the solutions to the usual insurance problems, is that you put some of the cost on each side. So if you imagine, say, not 75, but $60 an hour, plus we'll pay you $25 a machine per year. Some deal like that has the virtue that you've got malincentives on both sides, but two small malincentives may not be nearly as bad as one big one. You go back to the case of things like fire insurance. When you're insuring your factory, the fact that you've got it insured for 90% only results in you're not taking those precautions that are barely worth taking. That, you know, cost $9 and pay $9.50 or something. Whereas having insured for 90% means that you take almost no precautions at all. And similarly, you can imagine here that you want to set it up so that CGI has at least a little machine not to hire that farm boy to run the thing, because there's some cost to them when that breaks down. But RRR has at least some incentive to repair things in ways that will stay repaired, because it's losing a little money per hour on repairing. If you think about that kind of compromise, it might be worth thinking about. Not a problem. One of the possible solutions you might consider. other points occur to people? And again, one question not discussed in there is whether CGI being GCI. CGI is an initial for something. It's computer graphic something. What's the I-5? It's the way they do movies when they see is what CGI is. It's what they use confusing. But GCI, whether or not GCI has the option on the cost plus one of using other suppliers, because if they can, then that gives them a way of disciplining the firearm. Of course, there could also be a problem, because imagine, suppose it's the case that some of the GCI machines require much less skill to fix than others, as somebody was suggesting before in the case of the printer ink jam. You would then be worried from RRR's standpoint that the only ones they're going to call us on are the ones that require really sophisticated techs, so we're going to have to hire some more really high-end techs, or else our fixes aren't going to work with coming back and coming back. So you could imagine, as it were, opportunistic behavior on GCI's standpoint, in that RRR assumes that they're going to get both the easy and the hard cases, and then only give them the hard cases.
All right, those are all sorts of issues one would like to think about.
Any other additional terms that you can think about that might, other than promptness terms, that might improve this? Yep.
Well, I want to import some kind of term that's connected with the output of the office, tie their incentives to the performance of the office, because like the problem wasn't the office wasn't doing anything, or they were doing, their efficiency was very poor. And so if you could tie their interest to a better performing office, I think that would align your interest better.
Yeah. So the problem then is, can you measure the output? Because if the office is one chunk in the middle of an elaborate network of production, it's going to be very hard to independently measure what their output is. Whereas if what you're saying is, look, we are doing a particular measurable job. We're, you know, designing life insurance contracts or something. We aren't selling them. We're just, you know, we getting information. We use that information to figure out what terms to offer somebody. We didn't do it. We're getting a lot of other things of that sort. So if there's a measure, an easily measurable output, then that would suggest that you might say to RRR, we'll give you a bonus if our output gets above such and such. That's awesome. Yeah.
You
understand?
No.
It's actually kind of minor and kind of not field. I might also be interested in how RRR intends to pay for the parts, because like these days you have like credit cards that give you cash back, so if you can get like a 5% cash back on like, whatever item you're going to be.
But it's a much older problem than credit card, because the usual term is kickbacks. That's one of the sort of standard issues in things like international contracting and such. Is the way that we got the contract that we agreed that the colonel of the Air Force would agree they'd buy their planes from us, for every $1 million they give us, he gets 10,000. That would be a kickback arrangement. And it's a real issue, I should say, because on the one hand, people in the U.S. have this sort of feeling it's immoral to bribe people. On the other hand, if you're selling airplanes to a country where their routine way of doing stuff is that everybody, you know, increases his palm a little bit, you may not sell very many if you're not willing to do it. And that's sort of a real conflict that the U.S., I think, other countries like it face. But yeah, no, you're right, because you could imagine RRR, suppose they want to do nothing visibly illegal, and RRR has got a place that sells them parts. And the guy from RRR talks to his opposite number at that place and says, look, we've got this deal with GCI. They're going to be paying for the parts. If we agree to buy all our parts from you for them, do you think you can give us a really good price on the parts we need for some of our other work? No, it's not clear. Is that a kickback? Well, it really is implicitly, because then the seller will charge sort of their highest plausible price for the one market and then give you a little price for the other. And it becomes an interesting question, because how do you prevent that? You could imagine saying, well, here is how we're going to check the prices when you bill us for parts. Here are three wholesale distributors, none of which you're using. If your price is more than 10% above the lowest of their three prices for that part, you've cheated us and we're not going to pay. Imagine deals of that sort, but you're right, it's a perfectly legitimate problem, because not only have we discussed the issue of buying too expensive things because you aren't taking the time to search, or because you're on a cost plus and you want it to be expensive, but you're right, a further reason is you're buying things that are expensive because you're being bribed to buy them. Yep. Good issue. Yep.
Could you offer RRR a bonus if the machines last longer, just based on length of time that they don't have to?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. You could say, putting it differently, you could have a term which depended on downtime. That there are really two different dimensions you're interested in. One of them is the machine just dying and having to be replaced. The other is how much of the time the machine is being repaired and not available. And you could say, look, having the machines down, it doesn't merely cost us the money for paying you to repair it. It also costs us the productivity, so we can't use those machines while they're down, and that would suggest that maybe an additional term of the payment will be a payment which is larger the greater the uptime, basically, smaller the greater the downtime. With regard to the issue that if they might repair machines in under either contract in ways which don't result in their lasting a long time. So imagine on the fixed price contract, they could say to themselves, as long as you do a good enough job so it'll last out until the term of the contract is over, why should we care beyond that? And similarly on the cost plus, not clear depending on how much they're being paid per hour, but they might have the same instead of and going the other way, we have to worry about GCI buying machines that might break down a lot. How might you solve those problems? Think about, yeah?
That they bought a certain quality of machine for new
machines. That's one possibility from this GCI. But another possibility is that RRR could provide the machines. You could say, what we're really paying for RRR for is number of printer hours per year, say. So they provide the machines, we lease the machines, that's part of our payment. If the machine dies, it's their machine, not our machine, they are expected to bring us in another one tomorrow, that would also simplify things if you imagine a lawn repair, because then RRR will simply replace the machine, take it home, repair it over the next week, and then lease it to somebody else. So you can imagine a case where you shift who owns the machine as a solver, as a way of solving. All right, so we now have the next one, which, again, for whatever reason, I should be using Firefox, I guess, instead of Firefox is on this, but apparently its default is Windows and these Internet Explorers, so you shouldn't be surprised that there are problems. Isn't the size of the window, as far as I can tell, if I make the size of the window bigger, they just lengthen the line so as to keep overlapping. So let's just leave it like that for the moment. Monday, Wednesday issue was, I think, the question of getting to someplace out of town. what perfectly innocent reason might Jerry have for not showing up? What perfectly innocent reason might I have for not showing up to my class sometime in the last couple of weeks? He's sick, right? So we have to worry about sick or opportunism. By opportunism, I mean he's deliberately breaking the deal.
They might also be interested in like the level of his performance. Like he might give a really great show,
sure.
Or they might make him an average show.
Quality. They'd like him to have an incentive to give a high quality show. Now, one incentive is so they'll renew the deal next year, but other incentives as well. How are they trying to give him an incentive to make sure he gives a high quality show?
10% house profits.
He gets 10% of the house profits. And that presumably is one reason for doing it that way. What are the two things that they are especially, they are most concerned to make sure he shows up? I'm not asking for dates. What characteristics would those Tuesdays have? What characteristics might a Tuesday have where they thought it was really important that he show up? I've never run a nightclub, but I assume that their business is not uniform, you know, week by week.
It seems like they have an incentive for him to show up on popular nights when they don't have a more popular band than Jerry. They'd also have an incentive for him to show up on unpopular nights where they don't have another popular band.
What I was thinking of specifically is that I assume there are certain high demand nights, maybe New Year's or Christmas or something like that, when or I don't know, I've never run a nightclub. I've been in a nightclub sometime tonight. I know very little about nightclubs. But presumably there will be certain nights during the week when they can predict is really important. And the problem is that those are also the nights during the week when some alternative nightclub might be willing to offer him an especially large sum to play for them. So that's going to be a potential problem. How might you deal with that problem in advance? How might you want to modify this contract? Suppose they know that New Year's Eve is way their biggest. They are every other nightclub, the biggest night. So what might they? How might you want to modify the contract so as to avoid the risk that Jerry will call up and say, sorry, I just can't play, I'm very sick, and then they'll discover a week later that he was playing for a competitor that night. How might they make it less likely that that would happen by structuring a contract? Yep.
They could offer him non-monetary incentives, like they could publish his name, like, Jerry, are you playing on...
What's wrong with monetary? Why do they have to pay him the same amount every week? Yep. You could in general have some kind of a penalty, but what I was thinking of is you could avoid the problem if instead of saying we pay you $500 a night, we say we pay you $450 a night most nights and $1,000 a night for the four really popular nights of the year. And that way your incentive to bail on us is less. Your incentive to find some excuse to cheat us is less. We may be paying you the same total amount, but we are avoiding a situation where because we are, as if we're underpaying you certain days, you've got an incentive to try to get out of it. All right, so that would be one possibility, would be to have a more complicated payment system. We've been thinking mostly in terms of conflicts, but there's a sense in which if, imagine that Jerry has a really great opportunity to play out of town on Tuesday night or Monday or Wednesday night, they're going to pay him $2,000. From the same way as the nightclub, they'd like to have him that Tuesday night. They don't really have to. They can, you know, find somebody else. They can, you know, shut down for that something. They'd like to have some mechanism so that when it's really important to Jerry and not very important to them, he gets the Tuesday night off. And when it's really important to them and not very important to Jerry, he doesn't get the Tuesday night off. Right? Does that make sense? So how might you imagine doing that? What sort of terms might you include in the contract which are more complicated than just to agree to show up every Tuesday night that we want you?
Which, let me see, how did they do it in the original one?
So they guarantee him Tuesday, 26 Tuesdays. They If I understand this correctly, it sounds as though he is guaranteeing to show up for every Tuesday they ask him, and they are guaranteeing to ask him at least 26 Tuesdays. I think that's the...
Correct reading that contract?
Yes. That's what it looks like. So that under those circumstances...
Coordination? Scheduling? Ahead of time?
If they know, yeah.
Do you give each party, like, coupons, like either you have to show up coupon or I do not have to show up.
That is, you can imagine a deal in which Jerry is entitled to cancel with maybe more than a week's notice a certain number of Tuesday nights. And you might have a deal in which they are allowed to specify a certain number much smaller than 52 when he's agreeing not to cancel. Right? So you can imagine something in which they say, the normal expectation is if we want you, you're there. But we realize that won't always happen. So the deal is that at the beginning of the year, we'll tell you these are the four nights when you're absolutely booked, and you will pay a $2,000 penalty or something if you don't show up. Any other nights, let us know 2 weeks in advance, and you're off. All right? But you can only do that 10 times during the year. I mean, you can imagine a variety of things where the real objective is to make sure that those cases where the value to Jerry of being off is substantially larger than the value to them of his not being off, he ends up being off, and the ones that are the other way aren't. Does that make sense? Yes? No? So that would be a way you could try to structure the contract
in order to not try to really distinguish directly between Jerry's incentives and the nightclub's incentives at this point. My notes on this one.
So Jerry wants flexibility for his out of town gigs, and you can give him some ability to give them notice in advance. Other things you could do, suppose you say he can come, their real problem is not they have to have Jerry, but they have to have a performer. So you might say, all right, well, the deal is that you can cancel any Tuesday night, provided you can provide an adequate substitute. He gets the $500 and sends you. And then you'd have to agree in advance. Maybe here are three other performers in the area. The performers all know each other. You know, one of the other performers is his girlfriend. You could imagine lots of ways in which he might be in a position to say, I won't leave you with an empty stage, but it won't always be me. So that would be another possible way of doing it. My notes. Alternatively, it might be that anybody who they've hired in the last 6 months counts as a substitute if they thought he was good enough. That's a little bit risky because maybe they only hired him once because he did so badly, but that would be some measure. Also, yeah?
I don't know if that would be an alternative. Maybe if he loses one of the guarantee, if he doesn't show up, then he's going to take the higher price of getting regardless of whether they have an extra $500 for that.
Let's ask a different question. Why is it always Tuesday? What are the reasons that the contract might have been set up this way? What?
It's hard to find people.
One reason might be that Tuesday, for whatever reason, people are busy and the performers are busy, and therefore it's hard to do last minute arrangements, so they want to have somebody filled in. That's one possible reason. Any others? How about in terms of reasons that apply to both Jerry and the nightclub? Why might it be that instead of saying, we'll hire you once a week, and, you know, a week in advance we'll figure out what day it is, why might they want to make it always the same day? Who's involved in this other than Jerry and the nightclub? Fans, right? People attending. Well, if Jerry has his fans, which is not unlikely. There's people who really like Jerry, there's people who don't. If they know that Jerry is always there on Tuesday, now with only 26 nights, maybe they don't, but if he's there, Tuesday is when he's there, then people can say, all right, hey, let's go out to the nightclub. oh no, it's Tuesday night and Jerry's going to be there, we don't want to go there. Or alternatively, let's go out to the nightclub this week and let's make the plans for Tuesday, because with any luck, Jerry will be playing. So you could see that, to some extent, making it a regular thing is actually producing a benefit for both parties via a benefit for the customers, who after all are the ones who are ultimately paying both parties. So as I was saying before, if Jerry has an option with advance notice under the original contract, he may choose to take off the really high demand nights. And one reason he might do that is he can get lots of money from somebody else. What's the other reason he might call up the nightclub and say, look, this is your 1 month notice, not going to be there for New Year's. Sorry, I wanted to attend a good New Year's party. Why might he be doing that? Other than having an offer to be paid lots of money to play on New Year's. What's their response going to be when he... I mean, I'm assuming the contract says with a one-month notice he can cancel for up to 10 nights a year. So what are they going to do when he calls up and says, well, I've decided to cancel for New Year's?
Offer from
a higher price. So one of the issues we're going to worry about is... after the fact bargaining, where the reason he canceled isn't really he wants to go to a New Year's party. The real reason is to try to hold them up for more than a measly $500. All right. So that would be again a reason why you might want to agree in advance rather than, you know, more or less at the last minute when they don't know what they can do, to $1,000 for New Year's and $450 for other nights or something. Some arrangement along those issues. One of the issues we'd like to think about is terms of breach, because he might breach it either because he accepts an out-of-town contract more or less at the last minute when they want him, or as he said. So what are reasonable ways in which we might try to give him an incentive to show up when he said he should? What are plausible penalties for breach? First, he doesn't get his $500, but aside from that.
Do you kind of like the hand grenade and the drug deal thing? You do negative publicity, like Jerry missed out tonight, so we have somebody else? And painting his name as someone who misses his gigs?
You could, except that if you want to keep using him for the rest of the year, that's going to lose you some customers too, right?
Yeah.
So, but no, you could also, of course, try to pass the word not to the customers, but to other nightclub owners, other employers, say... And, you know, it's surely the case that in many industries there are informal or formal mechanisms by which people on one side can report on the quality of people on the other side. The case that I know something about is the diamond dealer industry, because Lisa Bernstein did a famous article a long time ago on that. That was an interesting case because it was an industry, a very trust-intensive industry, where almost all of the job of the law wasn't done by the law. It was done via reputational mechanisms. And basically, the early version of it, as I understand it, this is New York diamond dealers, was that the industry was dominated by Orthodox Jews. And they disapproved of suing each other. That was a wicked thing to do. On the other hand, they had respect for the same rabbis. So if they have a dispute, they can take the dispute to the rabbi. And if someone refuses to accept his settlement, that person's name is mud in that community. And the modern version is something called the New York Diamond Dealers Club, which all diamond dealers choose to be members of, I gather, and which has connections with the diamond industry in other parts of the world. So that the arrangement is that if you have a dispute about a deal with diamonds, you take it to the Diamond Dealer Association's arbitration. They give a verdict. If you refuse to abide by the verdict, your name is posted in diamond exchanges all over the world and people stop doing business with you. And so that's sort of an interesting case where private arbitration doesn't seem to have depended on the statement by enforcement by the law, but rather on a sufficiently tight-knit community, whether religious or just professional, so that people knew if you could be trusted, if you couldn't be trusted, they don't deal with you. There's, I don't know if any of you read much science fiction, but one of my favorite old science fiction novels by Robert Heinlein is called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And it's set on a moon in the future, on the moon in the future, which has gotten used as a penal colony the way Australia was. But there are irreversible effects from living on the moon because of the low gravity, so you really can't go back. And the result is that over time, you've accumulated a population of people who are legally free, but are sort of legally free people living inside a prison. That makes sense, legally speaking. And the prison authority doesn't really control them or do anything about them, and there is no government. And so they've developed their own sets of institutions for, you know, arbitrating disputes, enforcing rules, and so forth. And at one point, one of them is back on Earth, you know, in a wheelchair as part of things in the plot, and he's commenting how amazing things are on Earth. Why he says on Earth, they have laws for everything. They even have laws for private contracts. Why would you contract with a guy if his word wasn't worth anything? And it's sort of, part of it is just the fun of one of the things I like when writers do, is to show how to somebody in one, used to one set of institutions, they seem entirely natural and the alternative is just sort of incomprehensible. Either way, of course. I can think of another example of that, but I won't go into it, but a short story by Werner Vinge, where each side is interpreting the other side in their terms, as it were, and misinterpreting as a result. Well, I will tell you, it's a good story. The story's called The Ungoverned, and it's a future where some areas, again, have no government, are essentially anarchist, and there's an ungoverned area that's being invaded by an adjacent state. And in the ungoverned area, there are people referred to as armadillos. And an armadillo is somebody who basically is sort of like a gun nut, only on a larger scale. Somebody who's put money into his own defensive arrangements, and rather than contracting with other people about who will settle disputes, just doesn't deal with other people very much. And some teenagers deliberately distract the invading army onto the territory of an armadillo who's been there for a long time and has spent sort of all his resources building up defenses, and in fact has a private fortress. And it never occurs to the invading army they can just walk around it. Because it doesn't occur to them that this private fortress is not part of the defenses of the area they're attacking, even though they know that it formally has no government. But they believe that's just fake. It really hasn't. You know, they're really gangsters, is what they call them. And eventually, the final, sort of the last stage, when they finally destroyed all the defenses of the armadillo, is he has one last defense. He has an atomic bomb. And a very deep hole for his family to be in while the atomic bomb goes off over their heads. And it takes out like a third of the invading army. And somebody from the local private protection association, the sort of private organization that sells people the service of protecting their rights, is at this point, for some reason, a prisoner or an ambassador or something with the invading army. And the leader of the invading army is, you know, what kind of slime are you people using nuclear weapons against us? And he goes, what do you mean us? He's not our customer. And the difference between the two views of it, that one sort of assuming that territories are, as it were, politically unified. And the other said, no, I mean, he's my customer, he's not my customer. Why do you blame me for what he does? So it's, again, it's a good point. If you're ever writing novels, I suggest thinking about ways of showing how different people take things for granted. Anyway, going back to the subject, so one might just do with liquidated damages. One might just say, all right, the deal is that if you skip one when we've told you in advance we want you, the next two we don't pay you. And you show up. You owe us $1,000 of your salary on that. Or one could make it more flexible. You could say, well, look, if you back out with a month's notice, we'll only dock you $200. If you don't tell us at all and just don't show up, higher fine. That's the bigger problem. So you can imagine a variety of things of that sort. You might also think about the question of, do we have an exception when he's sick? What's the clearest evidence that he wasn't sick after the fact?
Play
another show. That's right, when you discover that he performed, you know, in another town 100 miles away that night. So you might say, you can imagine he's got to bring a note from his doctor, but, you know, that's sort of pretty easy to fake unless you know the doctor. You could have a doctor you know. You can imagine, depending how big the town is, that the deal is, look, we'll talk to your doctor in advance. We know him. He's, you know, he's my doctor, too. I trust him. He's an honest guy. If he says you were too sick to perform, we'll believe it. That would be one possibility. Another possibility to say is just you say, all right, we'll take your word for it unless we discover you played somewhere else. And you could imagine a variety of other variants of that sort of deal. And then again, you could imagine negotiation as ways of dealing with it. You could say, well, you've got the right to do X. You've got the right to cancel on 1 month's notice, but if you're going to do it, call us up. And if it turns out that this is the time we really want you, we'll offer to pay you some more money. And you can do it the other way as well. You can have the Jerry says, well, look, you gave me your 1 week's notice. That was yesterday. I just got this really good offer today. I'll agree to make my next performance at you a half price if you're willing to let me off. So you can think about setting it up in ways in which both sides are free to renegotiate for in their mutual advantage afterwards. Think about some of the incentives issues. Jerry's incentive to do a good job. One of them is 10% of the take. Got it. What?
Oh, it's creating more value for it,
I suppose. It clearly has a bunch of other incentives. I'm not even sure he needs the 10% in that sense, because you could argue, look, he likes being a star. You know, presumably rock stars enjoy being rock stars. You know, all the women want to go to bed with him, and everybody else admires him, and he gets offers from, you know, New York eventually, and, you know, how do you make it to, what's the name of the big performance place in New York City? No, there's a place. Carnegie Hall. You know the old joke. Someone says to somebody else in New York, I mean, tell me, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Practice. And you could imagine that he wants to get to Carnegie Hall. So you can think of lots of different reasons unrelated to the nightclub he wants to do a good job. But at the same time, you know, maybe those aren't sufficient. Maybe, you know, this tonight he's just broken up with his girlfriend, or he's been sick, or he could perform, but it's a real strain, and so he lets up and doesn't do as good a job. There are days when I come into class and I really don't feel like it. You know, sort of everything feels dead. You can probably tell by the end of the class those times too. And there are other times when it's really fun and exciting. Feeling alive and so forth. So presumably the same thing applies to Jerry, and therefore we're going to have to be concerned with whether he always does a good job and whether he comes when he says he will, and that we presumably could have punishments as a result. What about the nightclub? What are the ways in which we might be concerned about the nightclub's incentives? How does Jerry want the nightclub to behave beyond just keeping to the terms of the contract? What would he like them to do? Promote him, sure, because not only for his 10%, but for his very professional reputation, right? So he wants them to advertise his show. He wants them to do a good job of running the club, not to charge too much for drinks, to, you know, keep things clean, to do whatever things will bring in the audience, both, again, for his 10%, and because it's more fun to perform with lots of, you know, excited people listening to you.
I don't necessarily know. Like, or I think we would have to talk with Jerry to find out what his real interests are. Like,
yes.
Maybe he's not really all that interested in becoming really popular. Maybe it's more of like a hobby for him, or maybe he's just doing this kind of.
But you could also turn it around, and it may be that he's not really interested in the money.
Right.
My impression is I've got a nephew who does sort of, I guess, technical work, as it were, for small bands. Helps run their sound system and stuff. And the impression I've gotten from him, though I may be wrong, is that an awful lot of this musical performance is really a hobby. And that, you know, you want to make enough money to pay your expenses, and you hope that you'll break through and become one of the great bands, but that sort of, that it's, in a way, it reminds me of my impression of the novel writing world. That there are a bunch of people out there writing novels who don't really expect to ever publish them. Maybe they'll put them up on the web, maybe they'll show them to their friends, but they're really doing because they like writing novels. And it, in a sense, it matters for how you want to construct your contracts, that if you really believe that people are like that, then paying them money may not be a very important incentive, whereas guaranteeing them publicity or in various ways treating them nice, as it were. I mean, humans care about status, and, you know,
but my only point was that, like, I don't think that we can know for sure what
that's right.
What Jerry wants. If Jerry is still climbing his career, money's not so important, right. But reputation
yep.
is. If he's reached the pinnacle of his career, reputation, he's already earned as much of that as money's more important.
Right. And assuming you're the lawyer for the nightclub, what's one of the ways you'll find out what matters to him?
I can think of much different ways you can find out.
I was thinking the simplest way is you make offers and see which ones he accepts. Right? You know, if you say, look, I got this deal for you. We're only going to pay you $200, not $500, but we agree that the extra $300 will be spent on newspaper advertisements for your show. Right? If he says, great, I'm on. Make it $600. After all, you're getting some benefit, you know, from those ads too. But you could certainly imagine in the course of negotiation, one of the things you're feeling out is the other party's values by what offers he accepts or turns down. Another thing Jerry probably wants is for them to use him more than 26 nights a year, provided it's nights when he doesn't have another gig. So you might think about the question of how you would design the contract so that they have some to increase their incentive to use it. Suppose, let's put it differently. Suppose that on a night when he doesn't have another gig, his reservation price, the price for which he'd be willing to do it, if it was the best he could get, it's $100, not $500. So he'd rather do an extra gig for more anything more than $100 than sit home. Well, what's the obvious way of modifying this contract? 26 gigs at $500 and $300 for any additional gigs. Because now the nightclub has an incentive to use him more than the contracted limit a number of times, as it were, not guaranteeing it, and they have more incentive because it's going to be cheaper to do it. All right, so that would seem like a sensible arrangement, assuming his time really isn't worth $500 a night to him, which very likely isn't. Let's think about the verifiability issues. That is to say, start out with the 10%. Suppose you're an unscrupulous nightclub owner. And you agree to pay him 10% of profits, but oddly enough, there are practically no profits at all. What do you think might be going on? How do you cheat him out of his 10%? What's the very simplest way? Yeah, you lie, right? How does he know? He's not counting the money that comes in. So the very simplest way is you just give him a bogus set of figures for what you're. Short of that, suppose you aren't willing to lie to him. How do you arrange it that some of the income reaches your pocket without showing up as profits? What are some obvious things to do?
Pay yourself a salary.
Pay yourself a salary. That's right. You can. That's a cost, right? So it's not even a profit. If that's too obvious, hire your son as a part-time worker and pay him much more than his time is really worth. Have a second firm which provides inputs to the nightclub and belongs to you but is an independent firm and overcharges you. Yep.
Offer free food, free drinks, which gives you in return reputation for your business, or people like your business because you give
away. In particular, offer the free drinks on Tuesday nights in order that people will like your. You could do it in such a way that it's not explicitly. You could just say, you know, you're sort of the host. And, you know, Tuesday night, hey, you know, have another drink on me. And assuming people don't know it's only Tuesday night, they're more likely to come in because of being treated this way, and 10% of the money's coming from Jerry. Now, of course, 10% probably isn't enough for you to do very much of this. This would be much more of an issue if it was a 50% profit split kind of thing. But it's certainly worth thinking about that sort of thing. Similarly, other than the 10%, suppose we decide we really can't enforce that 10% agreement. It's too easy to cheat on it. Are there other ways in which we might reward Jerry based on how good a job he does, so as to give him an incentive to do a better job? What are some other measures that we've got available other than the amount of money we make for how good a job he's doing? Sure. The easiest is count the gate. And that he could probably come a good deal closer to checking. He could see whether the place was full or not. Or we could base it not on profit, but on revenue. Now I can still cheat, but not as easily. Now I can't cheat by bringing up expenses. All I can do is to actually hide money that's coming in. And he solves that problem because Jerry's girlfriend is the cashier. Or somebody he trusts is all. All right, so let's run through
some of the general issues we've been discussing, and you may be able to add some more that aren't occurring to me. Give these examples. One of them, which we were talking about mostly in the first case, is how do we avoid giving people perverse incentives? How do we avoid giving people incentives to buy cheap machines when expensive machines would really be better, to do a bad job repairing machines and so forth? And the other, which we were talking about a little bit more here, is how can we give them incentives where there is a gain to both sides to changing things to somehow change it? Things like saying, we'll pay you more on New Year's, we'll pay you less beyond 26 weeks, various ways so that you don't have a situation where the 27th performance costs him $100, is worth $400 and yet doesn't get made because it costs us $500, things like that. So that's one set of issues you want to think about, is structuring into a large buy. Another one is risk bearing. And we haven't talked about that for Jerry, but maybe we should have. In the basic contract, it's stated who is bearing all of the risk. Not to say all. What in the contract is stated, what does Jerry know he's getting? $13,000 a year,
right?
In exchange for 26 nights of performance. So there's still some risk because he's hoping maybe to have more than 26 nights, but at least a lot of the risk he's gotten rid of. What's the risk for the nightclub? Yeah, the risk is maybe he'll turn out not to do as good a job as we thought. We're locked into having him on Tuesday nights, 26 nights, and here his show has just been a flop for the last 3 weeks. So that's the risk division there. And then the one we were talking about a little bit on this term, which is verifiability. How well can we tell, given that we agree to a contract term, how readily can we measure whether people are really abiding by it? All right.
So those are all issues to consider in all of this, and we'll be looking at another contractual issue next time. All right. And I should say, I did not invent the answer provided by the people who did the book. So, well, if you think they're funny, give them the credit, not me.
In this right here, in Jerry's situation, I would want to know to what extent he can reschedule his big offers, his great one-shot offers. Because Jerry's going to pay for the privilege of being flexible. So the more flexible night owl is with him,
right,
the more Jerry's going to pay for that privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And so if his great one-shot offers can be rescheduled to Saturday nights or Thursday nights,
right,
then he needn't pay for the privilege of having a flexible
schedule. That's right. So if you were Jerry's lawyer, one of the things you would want to do is have a long conversation with Jerry about things about the industry you don't know, such as, you know, how often is it the case that you get an offer for a particular night only for that particular night? Because, you know, maybe the reason his big chance happens is that the star show canceled. And they need somebody, and, you know, Jerry is really good enough for our nightclub, but he's the best we can get. And if he goes over well, that's going to be great for him. In that case, he really wants the flexibility. Whereas the other case is, we like trying out a new act once in a while, so... No, you're right. Those are all legitimate questions. And sort of part of what you're really saying is that negotiating the contract involves not just sort of theory of contracts, a lot of factual information about the situation that the two parties are in. And that's absolutely right. All right. Thank you.